You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about research advancements in the area of psychedelic medicine to help with a range of mental health illnesses, including depression, anorexia, and addiction. Psychedelic drugs, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, they have been illegal in our country for decades. Some substances are Schedule I drugs, and that means they have a high potential for abuse and no currently accepted medical treatment here in the U.S. But now there's new research dollars and an increasing acceptance of psychedelic studies. So what do you want to know about psychedelic drugs and how these substances affect the brain? Have you or someone you know tried one of these drugs in a clinical setting? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alan K. Davis is an assistant professor of social work at The Ohio State University and an adjunct assistant professor at the New Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. Alan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. So we're going to have some terminology here this morning, including these psychedelic drugs. First of all, psilocybin and LSD. What are they? How do they affect the brain?
So these substances are in a broad class of what we call classic psychedelics or classic hallucinogens. These substances typically have primary effect on the serotonin system in the brain. And so that's the system that is largely responsible for things like regulating your mood and sleep and appetite. And so these substances also can produce pretty strong visual and emotional and physical experiences. In general, those kind of vary by time depending on the substance, but that's kind of a basic overview.
And, you know, some of these, like LSD, and you think of maybe the 1960s, how long have researchers thought these drugs could have therapeutic benefits? Where did they come from?
Well, you know, some of these substances have had, thousands of years of use in terms of indigenous use in ceremonial contexts. There were a lot of tribes in different parts of the world that would use these for healing and for personal growth. In the early 50s and 60s, these substances were also being widely researched, and there were a lot of studies published, over 1,000 studies published, showing that they had potential therapeutic benefit. And it wasn't until the Controlled Substance Act, where pretty much every substance was kind of labeled as problematic and banned for use. So when that happened, unfortunately, research ended for the most part. And it took about 2 to 3 decades for the regulatory hurdles to be overcome in order to start studying them again.
And then last fall, the Food and Drug Administration gave psilocybin therapy status for treatment-resistant depression. But then the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, still classifies it as a Schedule I drug. So how has research looking at these psychedelic drugs been stalled by federal regulations?
You know, it's been a real challenge. It's a huge hurdle to get through these different processes. For example, our recent study of depression that we're just finishing up at Hopkins, it took approximately 2 years before we could even start enrolling potential volunteers just to get through the FDA, the DEA, and of course the institutional IRBs. So it's a huge hurdle. It costs a lot of time and money, and it's a real challenge. You know, the reason that it hasn't been reclassified yet is because, you know, FDA is still yet to have enough evidence to consider approving it for wide use in clinical settings. And until that happens, the DEA is unlikely to make any changes to their scheduling process.
We're talking about advancements in psychedelic medicine. What's on the horizon for upcoming studies with Alan K. Davis? He's a researcher at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. You can join in. Have you had a negative or positive experience with psychedelic drugs? Have these drugs had a therapeutic effect for you or the opposite? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, so far, Alan, what have researchers learned about the therapeutic uses of psychedelic drugs? What are some of the more aha moments here?
Well, you know, one of the really, you know, amazing recent findings that I'm actually going to be presenting today at the University of Michigan is that our depression trial found that after only two doses, so two sessions of psilocybin alongside about 13 sessions of psychotherapy, we found that people with chronic long-term depression, about 60% of them completely remitted from their depression after that intervention. And that's huge. That's about double the amount of people that have a remission from depression as related to antidepressants or psychotherapy alone.
So with that, armed with that knowledge, where do you take the trials at this point when you have results that look so promising?
So actually, that stuff is already in process, which is great. And it's actually being led by a company in Madison, Wisconsin. USONA Institute has launched and is backing a multi-site phase 2 and 3 trial for depression. And that multi-site trial will enroll many more participants across many sites around the country. And that's the type of data that the FDA will then use to decide whether or not it should be made available to the public.
So surveys have found therapeutic effects for some recreational users of these drugs. What do you make of that finding, also given that you have these clinical findings?
You know, I think that there are still some risks involved with, you know, people deciding to do this on their own, and I would caution listeners to be safe with their choices. However, these substances, like I mentioned earlier, have been used for thousands of years, certainly in the case of things like psilocybin mushrooms, and so there's a long history of safe administration and safe experiences. However, one thing that we know from the trials is that having a safe setting, so having a safe environment with supportive people who know how to help in case something challenging comes up, is a real critical component about why we think these are effective. Now, there are some people who do have recreational experiences, or they'll go to some other type of, you know, non-research setting to have these experiences, and they do report that these substances can bring about spontaneous changes in their mood for the better. Some people don't even expect that to happen, but it happens and they kind of realize that the benefits are there.
Well, walk us through what that might be like for safe administration in a safe setting for something like psilocybin.
Well, you know, some of the things that we've seen in our survey-based research, when we ask people about what kinds of practices they use to keep themselves safe when they use these substances, they actually look very similar to the kinds of practices that we might employ in a research setting. So, for example, having someone that you trust there who is not using psilocybin, but who can kind of be a sitter or someone to go to for support if you need it, seems to be an important factor. Also, having, you know, a thoughtful intention or moment to reflect on the reasons why you're seeking out this experience seems to be helpful to help kind of guide the internal experience that one might have. But also things like making sure you're in a safe setting, making sure that you have the things you need, like, for example, music ready and other things to kind of make sure that your whole experience is a supported one.
How long might that experience take when you give a dose?
Well, for psilocybin, it's the acute effects of the substance are anywhere from 4 to 6 hours, depending on the person's body weight and their metabolism, and of course the dose of the substance. For something like LSD, that quickly doubles or triples. That can be up to 10 to 12 hours. So it really varies a lot by which substance you're talking about.
We're talking about research advancements in the area of psychedelics. Ellen K. Davis is an adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. What are your questions about, you know, how hallucinogenic drugs work, like LSD, and how they can impact mental health conditions and how these substances actually affect the brain? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about psychedelic medicine. Some studies suggest compounds in mushrooms could be beneficial for treating anxiety, depression, other mental health issues. And this is a real jumping off point for a center on psychedelic medicine that just opened at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And their upcoming studies will determine the effectiveness of psilocybin as a new therapy for treating opioid addiction, for treating Alzheimer's, PTSD, anorexia, other areas of mental health. Do you have a chronic depression or other mental illness? Would you consider trying a non-conventional therapy? Join in 800-642-1234. Alan K. Davis is our guide. He's an adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins. Let's go to the phones now. Jonathan is joining us from Walworth. Hi, Jonathan.
How's it going this morning?
Good. Go ahead.
So I just wanted to kind of reinforce what your guest said about these medicines being used for thousands of years and how it's kind of unfortunate that Western society has demonized them. But for me personally, I've been battling with, a lot of trauma from my childhood, from heavy neglect, battling with obesity and other things like that. And, psychedelics and most prominently psilocybin had a huge impact on helping me to overcome some of that and to overcome obesity and to become a stronger person. And now with just some traditional talk therapy and occasional, maybe yearly use of psilocybin, I'm able to maintain a very high state of function and not really fall into depression. And it's an amazing medicine. And I fully hope that people can get on board with this and help doctors do the work that they need to do to help people.
Jonathan, thank you for telling your story. Alan, it sounds like Jonathan has a history of here that is really working.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that keeps us inspired to continue, the work that we're doing to overcome the regulatory hurdles with the different federal agencies, because we know that people are experiencing these kinds of benefits. We're seeing that in our trials, and we're hearing from people like Jonathan. And yeah, it's pretty remarkable to hear the kind of effects he's had.
Let's go to Sam now in Oconomowoc. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. Yes. I had a 30-year-plus habit of addiction, call it what it is, to cocaine. I could not get away from it. I had gotten to the point where I decided that at any means I was going to find a way away. And it wasn't looking good. The solutions that was coming up in my head. Somebody pointed out that psilocybin had been used for trying to treat heroin addiction. So I tried. I am now cocaine free for over 3 years. I also, in the time since then, have helped three other heroin addicts wean themselves off and get away from heroin. And using the psilocybin as a kind of crutch, I guess, in term, and they're away from their heroin habits, and we don't recreationally use the psilocybin, but as a tool, it was a lifesaver.
Well, Sam, thanks for calling in. Alan, what is the impact? What do we know here about psychedelic drugs, perhaps helping people kick an addiction like cocaine?
Well, one thing that we think is going on is actually what we kind of label a transdiagnostic process of change, which basically means that we think psilocybin has an ability to induce in people experiences that are intensely positive and transcendent and spiritual or mystical in nature. And at the same time, they also have the capacity to bring about very strong psychological insights. And this quantum level of change that we call it seems to help people with a variety of problems, including addiction, as well as people who have trauma or depression or anxiety or existential distress. So that's one of the reasons why we're going in the direction of these other populations, people with PTSD and opiate use problems, debilitating conditions that also have at their core some of these same basic processes that could be helpful for them.
Upcoming studies that you have also include patients who have Alzheimer's and PTSD. What about these specific populations of people battling diseases like Alzheimer's?
Well, you know, one of the landmark studies that we published a few years ago was done in cancer patients, and the psilocybin was not used as a treatment for cancer, obviously, but it was used to help people who, because of their cancer diagnosis, they became depressed or anxious. And that psychological distress is very debilitating. And what we know in the literature is that that psychological distress that happens when people have a terminal illness actually reduces their quality of life and makes it much more difficult for them to connect with their families and engage with the time they have left. And so the same is true with Alzheimer's. And so we're hoping that, you know, by working with Alzheimer's patients and their families, that we might help people, you know, to decrease that psychological distress and help them engage in a higher quality of life.
We're talking about psychedelic medicine. What's on the horizon for hallucinogenic drugs like LSD? Alan K. Davis is our guide. He's a researcher at Johns Hopkins University at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Brian now in Milwaukee. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for taking my phone call. I think you touched a little bit on my question, answering my question, which was kind of two parts. So, number one, how the subjects with depression, what do they report, how the drug works, why it works for them? And then the second part of my question is just, how do you go about standardizing the clinical setting for when you're going through the drug trials? How do you go about standardizing the setting and the experience for these participants?
Brian, thanks. Ellen, go ahead.
Yeah, so in terms of the recent question about the setting, one thing that we do is that the setting is not your typical hospital setting or research setting. In fact, the environment where the sessions take place, it looks much more like your living room in your own home. We have a couch and tables and floor rugs and nice lighting with table lamps and chairs and bookshelf. And what we've done is we've done what we can to create as peaceful and calming environment as possible. And we also invite the volunteer who's there for the study to also make the room their own and bring in pictures and any other things that they want from their own home environment to create a comfortable space for themselves. And we think that that's part also answers the first part of the gentleman's question about what we think is helpful. You know, having that calming environment seems to create a sense of safety so that people are able to trust and let go and be open into whatever experience comes up as part of their psilocybin journey. And those experiences that people then come back and report on as being helpful to them, you know, as I mentioned earlier, often include things of a spiritual or transcendent nature. People usually come through this experience feeling connected in a more deep way to themselves and to their families and to community, and for some of them also to God or a spiritual connection, and the insights that they get as part of that, the ways in which they take that information and actually apply it to their day-to-day life seems to be what creates and supports a lasting change.
Brian, thanks. Justin in Kenosha is with us. Justin, hi.
Oh, hello. Good morning. Thanks for taking my phone call. I'm really glad to hear about this, these advances. I'm a social worker, and I have a lot of patients and clients who have severe alcohol use disorders, and I kind of had two questions. One, I'm wondering how long it'll be until this could be like a mainline treatment, because the mainline treatments are really not very effective.
Oh, I'm sorry, Justin. It sounds like you just dropped. Basically looking, what is the timeline until, you know, social workers and other medical professionals might be able to use this in their clinical practice?
You know, we're still some years away from that. It'll be at least a couple of years before FDA will have the type of evidence that it needs to make a ruling on whether it should be made available as a treatment. And once it's made available as a treatment, you know, that will put the DEA in a space where they'll need to decide whether or not to reschedule the psilocybin. And if and when that happens, I think that we will see the ability to not only do a lot more research, which can then, you know, give kind of evidence that we need to make it a frontline treatment for different conditions, like people with alcohol use problems. But this is still kind of in its early stages before this will be made available widely to the public.
Justin, are you still there?
Oh, yeah, still here.
Yeah, did that answer your question?
Yeah, I had one other question. I was wondering how I could get involved and how I can be more helpful with this.
Well, you know, one of the things that is going to be crucial for this work going forward is for people to, in the community, both, you know, people like Justin, who's a social worker and a provider of clinical services, as well as families and other people, to start to have a dialogue about, you know, what would it look like if you had a family member or a client who's had these experiences? How can you support them in their process of change? And one of the things that I think we'll need to do as a culture and in various communities is to create places where conversations can take place about these types of experiences. So having dialogue, talking to community members and family members about, you know, what you're learning or what you're seeing and what you're reading, those conversations will go a long way to support the work when it eventually is widely disseminated.
Alan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alan K. Davis is an assistant professor of social work at The Ohio State University and an adjunct assistant professor at the Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University. Coming up, New State data is out on standardized testing results this morning from the Department of Public Instruction, and the results show a narrowing of the achievement gap, but only because white students' performances declined, not because scores by African American students increased. We'll break down the New State data right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.